I don't know who. The Rock is here, by the way. But he's seeing. I don't know who he's seeing. He's seeing the Steven, or he's seeing me, and or he's seeing both. Okay, The Rock seems to be like Freshard, maybe. Eh? Is that the Freshard? Both. Okay, great. Oh, there. Okay, there. I can see Steven. Okay, Steven, I'll just start introduce you, and then you can go on. Okay.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yes, I'm all ready.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I think people will be joining as we go along. In Malaysia, as I said the second time in a row, we are known to be punctually late, so it's good to introduce you. So by the time I've introduced you, probably more people will be attending. Anyway, this is welcome to IMU Learning webinar series. My name is Zed Alsagoff. I'm the e-learning manager at IMU, the International Medical University. Today, we will be actually talking to Stephen Downs. Will be conducting the session, and he'll be talking about facilitating massive online facilitating a massive open online course. Short form is a MOOCs. He works for the National Research Council of Canada, where he has served as a senior researcher based on Moncton, New Brunswick. I think you have to tell us how that's pronounced.
Yeah, it's pronounced.
Since 2001,
Moncton, New Brunswick.
Affiliated with the Learning and Collaborative. Okay. Affiliated with the Learning and Collaborative Technologies Group, Institute for Information Technology. Downs specializes in the fields of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. Okay, that was he sent on. Basically, from my experience, learning from him for the last few years, he preaches and importantly practices free learning. For example, he published online The Old Daily, which I hope you all are going to subscribe to or are subscribing to, which is a newsletter he publishes about 5 times a week, where he curates and makes sense of the latest trends and issues in the world of learning. He has actually published more than 1,200 articles online, or nearly. I think it's about 1,175 that I saw on his website since 95. If you want to see his slideshare presentation, he has more than 200 there. He also has, I'll share the links later. And he also has a half an hour blog, which according to him is a place where he writes half an hour every day just for himself, which he's been doing since 2005. There's a lot of interesting things and reflections there you might want to explore. He has also developed
Sound is cut out.
An application, I don't know if it's in beta version, the Grasshopper, with personal database and a personal publishing. It allows you to organize your online content any way you want, to import content and blah, blah, blah. It's an interesting tool. Actually, I think you use it for your MOOCs now, right? And finally, before we start the session, he has something called the Stephen Guide to the Logical Fallacies. Yes, I wouldn't try getting into an argument with him, whether he is right or wrong. He will probably win the discussion anyway. Okay, so that's a small taste of what Stephen Downs has contributed to the world of learning. I will share the links, by the way, in the chat box. So let's give him a warm welcome for taking his time to be with us today in the chat box. And I'll pass it over to you. And from now, I will not be talking anymore, and it will be Stephen Downs until he's finished. Thank you very much. Okay,
well, hello, everyone. And there is about a 3 or 4 second audio delay, probably caused by the speed of light, since we are, of course, communicating from opposite sides of the world, which I still think is a miracle. I'm amazed that we can do this. I'm assuming that you can hear me, and if you have any issues, I can watch the chat room, and you can type a note in the chat right where I've typed here, and I will see your message, and I see Zed is typing, and I expect something to pop up there shortly, and Zed is saying, yes, he can hear me. Excellent. So, I am broadcasting today from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. If you're wondering where Moncton is in the eastern part of Canada. We're just a few miles away from the Atlantic Ocean. We get ocean weather and all of that. I've sent some slides. I meant to put more pictures on the slides than I did. It's one of these things where you start creating the slides and it's, oh, I should add this, and oh, I should add that. So I got a lot of content on these slides, not so many pictures. Is there a way of sharing a web screen on this? Zed, if you can tell me if there is or there isn't. If not, I think I can just paste pictures into. Oh, there is. Excellent. I'm going to want to share. I'm going to want to share some websites as well. So if you can point me to it or direct me to it. I don't see the control here anywhere. I'm sure it's somewhere. Anyhow, look for the screen button. Yes, I see the screen button. Oh, okay, and this allows me to share. Okay, so, all right, so we'll try that in a little bit. So, the topic of this session is how to stage a MOOC. This is a very practical not hands-on, because, you know, we don't really have a computer lab in front of us, but very practical-oriented session. I'm going to talk about what we do here in Canada, and by we, I mean myself, I mean George Siemens, who works with me on many of these MOOCs, Dave Cormier, who works with us on many of these MOOCs, and also people like Jim Groom Carol Yeager and others, Inga Duard, who have also hosted MOOCs. But before we want to start off with that, I really need to talk about what a MOOC is. And if I had to say it in just a second or two, I'd say a MOOC is chaos, but that might not really convey the idea that I want. What a MOOC is, essentially, is a distributed course. By that, what I mean is that not everything takes place in a single environment or a single learning management system. Rather, all of the course activities, the action, if you will, of the course, takes place in a distributed environment. Each individual participant participates in their own environment. I wonder if I can paste an image in here. I wonder if that'll work. It doesn't look like it. Let's go to the whiteboard. And can I paste? I can see if I can paste an image in here. Nope. I'm trying to learn this system on the fly. It's probably a bad idea. There's text, graph, eraser, special shapes. No, it doesn't look like, let's see. No, I don't think I can paste an image in. Okay. Gee, that's too bad. Okay, well, I'll come back here then and go back to the screen. And let's see. Oh, upload picture. So I actually have to upload it. And I'm just running the screen sharing application. So now it is sharing my screen. Upload, you suppose, yeah. And that's my email with Zed's panicked emails. So what I'm trying to show you is this image here. And I'm hoping you see this image. And now I'm done showing you this image. So I'm going to try to come back to the screen, stop sharing your screen. Now, if somebody in the chat room could tell me whether that worked, that would be really helpful. So, and what you should have seen was a picture with blogs and Twitter posts and all of that linked in all together, connected to each other. And you might think that's kind of an odd sort of way of doing it. But the thing is, with a MOOC, what's really important is the connections that are created between people. What's really important is, oh, I can draw. So you have a blog, a blog, a blog, a blog, a Twitter account, a Facebook account, another blog, another blog. This is my account here. This is Zed's account. Here's George's account. And the idea of a MOOC is that we're connecting each other. We're sending each other messages. I'm sending messages to you. You're sending messages to me. You're sending messages to your friends. And the idea is that as time goes by, we go by week by week by week, and each week The idea is to have a general topic of discussion, but not a curriculum that we need to learn or memorize or anything like that. The idea here is that the topic of the discussion gets us off the ground. The topic of discussion gets us looking for resources, gets us creating resources, gets us sharing our ideas. The important thing is to participate in the MOOC. And by participating in the MOOC, within this topic area, we become more and more familiar with the topic area. And the idea is to become like a person who works in a regular way, who works in a professional way in that topic area. Now, this session, though, is focused on the practical aspects of creating a MOOC rather than the theory of many other sessions that talk about the theory. But in this session, I really want to focus on the practicalities. What do we do? So let's move on to the next slide. First, I'm going to begin talking about the elements of a MOOC. The elements of the MOOC are the technologies that we use in order to create the MOOC, the different applications, the different programs, the different services. Unlike a regular online course, there is not one single application that we use, but because the course is distributed, we're going to be using a wide number of different applications and different services. Now, to begin with, a MOOC actually begins to look very similar to an ordinary course. We begin by creating the syllabus for the course. Now, there's a bit of a history there. And the history is that the first MOOCs that George and I created were actually created as part of a program set up by the University of Manitoba. And what was important here was that we follow the university's regulations regarding courses. And there are certain minimal standards that we had to follow. One of these was to have a course syllabus. It meant as well that we had to have a start date, we had to have an end date, we had to have a regular schedule and all of that. And that was a good idea. It actually sort of brought us into more focus. Previously, I had been doing the same sort of thing, but not as a course. And Zed mentioned my newsletter, which I've been doing for more than 10 years now. And my newsletter is the same sort of thing as a MOOC, except not as a course. So what we did when we developed the first MOOCs is that we took something that was ongoing, and we sort of chopped it up so that it had a concrete start date and a concrete end date. I personally resisted this. Going to be in a course, that's a bad idea. But what I realized is when you do something over the long term, like I have with my newsletter, with the sharing the resources and all of that, you got the regular people, the regular partners in communication, the regular resources, the regular feeds. But when you set up a course with a concrete start date and end date, it's almost like mixing that up. You get people you never saw before and might never see again. You get different lines of communication, different resources. So it's by creating these one-off events, by creating temporary networks, we're able to change the dynamics of the overall networks of connection between people. I know people now that I never knew because of these courses. I know people now that I never knew because of the courses I've taught, and I know people now that I've never knew because of the courses that I've taken. So anyhow, we come up with a syllabus. Syllabus is very standard, I don't think the screen sharing really is going to work that well, but let me try it anyways. Now I should be sharing my screen. Where's it? Here we go. Here's a sample syllabus. This is the syllabus from the Learning Analytics course, And you can see there's nothing unusual about this at all. There's a course description that describes the overall intent of the course, the content that it's intended to cover. There's the course tag. This is something that's new for online courses. You wouldn't see this in a traditional course. You might not even see this in a traditional online course, but for a distributed course, having a course tag is really important. What a course tag is a unique identifier for the course that you will use in Twitter messages or Facebook messages, etc., that people can follow. The course tag for learning analytics, for example, starts with that hash symbol, as most tags do, hash LAK11. We have a course on right now. It's change. The course tag is hash change 11. We're also running a connectivism and connective knowledge course, and the course tag for that is hash CCK12. The idea here is you want to use a string of characters that will not show up in ordinary conversation elsewhere. As time goes by, these are going to have to get more and more specific. But it's still pretty easy to come up with a unique tag. LAK11, for example. This does not show up except anywhere else except with specific reference to the course. Continuing with the overall course outline or syllabus, description of the audience, the intended audience, I think that's important. It's not as important as it would be for traditional courses. One of the really interesting things about MOOCs is that you get people from all different skill levels. And this is really helpful because the people who are more advanced are able to advance their own knowledge by helping people who are less advanced. People who are less advanced are learning directly by observing people who are more advanced. So instead of staging people through level 1, level 2, level 3, a MOOC will typically take place in a single environment, and then there might be some sub-clustering or sub-grouping between beginners and experts and even ultimately researchers. But we do not separate them out into different levels ahead of time. If there is any separating out, this will happen of its own accord by students doing their own separating. Course outcomes. This is the sort of thing that universities require. I am less firm on course outcomes. My belief is that everybody who enters a course has a different intended outcome, and that each person defines his or her outcome. And I think this is more interesting because when people have different objectives, that means they do different things. And by many different things happening, that's where we get some of the interesting synergies in the course. List of facilitators, there should be contact information as well. I notice there isn't here on the learning analytics thing. Important links, and George also lists the technologies that are used. So those are the overall elements of the syllabus. Again, not a whole lot that's new, but some stuff that's new. Now, as I mentioned, there is an outline in a MOOC and a schedule for a MOOC. And this outline and schedule will contain the typical sorts of things that you might expect in a MOOC. It'll indicate deadlines. Like if, for example, there are deadlines for registration. I tell people they can register in a MOOC whenever they want. It doesn't matter whether 1 week has passed or 10 weeks have passed. But if the MOOC is for credit, the university might have a different point of view. Any synchronous sessions, live online sessions, like the one we're doing right now, need to be scheduled, preferably far ahead. We're learning with the change course that if you leave it to the last minute, it really has an impact on attendance in the sessions. Topics, if you're covering different topics week by week, then you need to list these topics in your schedule. If you've organized guest speakers, and that's very common in a MOOC, it's almost a standard practice to have guest speakers. And then if there are any assignments. There are two types of assignments. If somebody is taking a MOOC for credit, then they'll have official assignments that will be graded by somebody. And in my MOOCs, that somebody is not me. I don't really believe in grading assignments. Otherwise, there are activities, and this is something that is really encouraged, to have people do activities. It's really easy in one of these MOOCs to just have people sit back and watch the video and read the readings, but it's really important to get them involved and have activities. One of the courses, Jim Groom's DS-106 course, is really good at getting people to do activities. In order to arrange this or to set this up, then Zed's saying, where am I? So somebody has stopped my video. I didn't stop my video. I'm still here. Basically, I think what's happening is people are logging on. As you suggested, Zed, they're logging on late and popping their video in, and that's interrupting us. But if you can see me and hear me, just let me know. No, just your assistant. Yes, you do see me and hear me. Excellent. Okay, I'll keep going. And I'm going to try the screen thing again. So I'm hoping the screen sharing is working for you guys. I just want to pop in here and show you some of the stuff that we've done for the MOOC. For example, here's the MOOC schedule for Change 11. And what we've done is we've set up a Google Docs spreadsheet. Each week is listed. We have the facilitator for the week. We have the topic for the week and information, some contact details for that person. There's other stuff we should have had in this schedule right from the very beginning that we didn't have. For one thing, we needed to have one of us, George, myself, or Dave, clearly responsible for each one of these sessions. That's kind of hard to do. We all travel. We all have commitments. But we should be recording that. Right now, we're not even recording that, and that's causing a bit of a weakness. And as well, we should have firm commitments from the speakers on what time they are going to speak. Right now, for example, we're in a week where we have Geetha Narayanan speaking. I still don't know when she's going to speak. And it's Tuesday night here, and her week ends Friday. So obviously, you know, we need to be getting firmer commitments. It's really hard to work with volunteers like that, and you have to be really gentle with them. These are very often professionals, leaders in their field. Geetha, for example, directs a center. She's very busy. So you have to be gentle with them, but at the same time, if they agree to participate, you really need to be clear about the expectations. I'll return to that topic later on. Other places where we can put in schedules. Let me just see if I can't find one really quickly. You can put in a wiki. You can set up a course schedule in a wiki. So here, for example, is... Oops. Here, for example, is the wiki page. It's a media wiki page for Connectivism and Connective Knowledge 2008. And what you can see is we've just simply created different pages for each week. It's a lot less structured than the Google Docs spreadsheet, but we have the links in there. We have a lot, you know, the announcement of when the sessions are going to be held, all of that. The nice thing about the wiki is anybody can edit it, so people can add resources and all of that. But, you know, my experience is, so far, people aren't doing that. The wikis tend to be managed by the people who are running the course and not so much by people who are participating in the course. It's kind of too bad, but really, in a sense, there's no way to avoid that. One of the things I really recommend, and this is something that people should consider doing, is using Google Calendar. or some such thing for the course schedule. Now, we've been trying to do this in the Change 11 course without a whole lot of luck. I'll just pop into the Change 11. What we've done here is I've actually put the calendar right on the home page. This is just an image link. I just created a little tiny image and of a calendar and created that as a link to the course calendar. Here's the page with the course calendar embedded in it. So you can see that it has all of the Change branding, it has the menu along the side, and it has the calendar here in the page area. Google calendars can be embedded in web pages, in just about any sort of web pages. That's what really makes them useful. Of course, the other thing you see here is none of our events are in the calendar. The other hard part is getting people to schedule the event in the calendar. People need, and again, it's one of these things, setting expectations and following through. And I didn't do this for the Change course. I will do this for any future course with any partners that I have. And the expectation is, if so-and-so schedules the event, so-and-so will put them in the Google Calendar. And the reason why this is important is because if we pop into the Google Calendar, here's the Google Calendar page itself. Now, if you go to this calendar in your Google account, as you can see, you're seeing my Google Calendar account here. So you're seeing the Laurel Arts seminar I have tomorrow. We're partway through the ZLearn seminar. I'm taking French lessons Thursday and Friday, except I've been, anyhow. If you view the course calendar inside your Google Calendar, you can add to it. So here is, in fact, the Change 11 sessions. There are none. That's why you don't see any. But if I back up a ways where we did have it, see, here we have the Change 11 sessions are included right with my own calendar. I'm surrounded by cats. Andrea's taking one cat away because he was about to jump up on the desk, and another cat jumps up on the desk. Such is my life. So it's so useful. Now, there's all kinds of things, and again, it's a separate session, but if you have a Google Calendar going, you can feed it into Outlook. If you use Outlook, you can have it send you email messages to remind you of things. It's just a good thing to have, and it really helps people organize their lives. So if possible, if you're using a schedule, I do recommend using something like Google Calendar. Zed is asking, how many cats do we have? We have 4 cats. We have the 2 older cats, Bart and Polly, and their real names are Castor and Pollux, but we call them Bart and Polly. Oh, Polly's got a nasty scratch on her. Polly's been fighting with Alex lately. Anyhow, those are the older cats, and then we have the 2 kittens, Lexi and Alex. So, yeah, we have 4 cats altogether. And yeah, that's a nasty scratch there, Polly. And they're having dominance fights. How do you sync Google Calendar with Outlook? Off topic, and I can't cover it because it would take too much time, but there are ways to do it, and I'm only going to be able to recommend that you look it up. There is information on Google. There's a plugin you can use for Firefox that'll update it. There's also, I think as well, there's a plugin that you can use for your Outlook as well. Nancy White is typing. She's probably providing the solution, as she always does. Moving on. The next thing to set up is a registration page. Hi, Carol. Nice to see you. A registration page is not strictly necessary, but I find it really useful. I use Grasshopper. For those of you who are not familiar with Grasshopper, Grasshopper is an application that I authored myself. I'm going to start the screen sharing again here and just pop you into... I have to be careful not to move out of the... I have to be careful not to move out of the actual session page because it's embedded inside my browser window. So Grasshopper is an application that I've created myself. It's a personal web environment that combines resource application, a personal data space, and personal publishing. It's an open source application, and I can give you code, but I've been really busy, and I'm actively developing it. I do have code updates. They're not very good at the moment, and as usual, I say, give me time. People have successfully installed it. What I want to do is set up a hosted version. That's my target. That's my ambition. But, you know, it's one of these things. I need time and money to do it. I might try doing a Kickstarter on that. I need to get formal permission from NRC, but if I could do a Kickstarter, that would pay for the server. Then I could set up the hosting. Then we're away to the races. Totally different project, though. Anyhow, so with Grasshopper, here's one of my screens in Grasshopper. This is a screen that I use for my website. But I'll log out of here. And now when we come to the website, there's a login screen. And so if you just click on the login screen, you can see it's just a standard login screen. I ask people for their username and their password. And one of the things I do here is I get their email address, and then I have them subscribe to a number of email newsletters. And that's what the purpose of the registration is going to be, is for subscription to the email newsletter. There's no other purpose to it, to my mind. The one other purpose is to sign your comments on discussion boards. But I mean, the idea here, and a lot of people say, oh, you need to get registration, da 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 da. If people are signing up for credit, yes, they need to register, but they need to register with the university, and I don't care whether they register with the course. It's not really a necessary thing. If they want to receive the newsletter, they need to tell me where to send it. That's pretty simple. If they want to put their names on their comments that they make, they need to tell us what their name is. And beyond that, you know, there's all kinds of talk about tracking and all of that. I'm not really convinced that tracking individual people in this way, you know, is strictly necessary. That said, we'll see later on, people have other accounts that are connected, their Facebook account, their Flickr account, and all of that. And if I'll log in here, Oh, it's going to be annoying, isn't it? I'll log in here. That's a little bug I haven't discovered before. And I have to remember what my password is. I have a number of different passwords, and I'm never sure which one is active on which site at any given time. So that's a really good security measure. Now, in the options, I also try to collect social network information. And this is something that you can do. So, for example, you can enter in your Facebook ID. You can enter your Twitter ID. I'm working on expanding this so that I can collect a whole set of social network identities, and then that allows me here to be able to associate the person with the Facebook account, with the Twitter account. But, you know, it's really important that this be voluntary and not required. And it's really important, in my mind, that this serve an objective of the course. And finally, I think it's really important that this information be kept secret and not shared with, say, companies and businesses are not posted on the web. People keep their identities separate. And this is so much so that entire companies, like, say, Clout, have been founded on the simple premise of, I will connect this account with this account with this account with this account. And that's why all of these websites are doing, you know, the connect with Facebook, connect with Twitter. They want to join Facebook accounts with email addresses so that they can create composite identities from different accounts. So it's useful to have in your course, but it's important not to feed into that out there in the world. You don't have to use Grasshopper to take a retreat, Stephen. I'm not sure what that means. Oh, okay, I get it. To do the Grasshopper stuff. That would be really cool if I could do that. I would love to do that. I'd love to, like, take a year off, focus on Grasshopper, get it out, but my life doesn't work that way. So, but you don't have to use Grasshopper. Another way you can get people to sign up for the course is Google Docs. Or another way you can get people to sign up for the course is with Google Groups. There are many ways of collecting people's registrations. I won't go into them all here, but the main thing I want to point out is there are ways of collecting registrations, but you should do it only if you're going to use them for some purpose, if you're going to use them to distribute resources or to put names to comments. All right, moving on. Course pages, you know, it's funny, you don't think about these things until you actually run a few courses. First time we ran the Connectivism course, we didn't have any of these. We sort of created these on the fly during the course. Now I have a whole bunch predefined, and I just copy the whole set of them from one Grasshopper account into another Grasshopper account. It's like Insta-course. It's wonderful. The homepage, obviously, we've learned from experience, we need to update on a regular basis so that people can go to the homepage to find out what's new. The calendar page, which I showed you already, and about this course, which will link to the syllabus, an outline, which includes the schedule, something about the course facilitators. It's a good idea to have pictures, bio, contact information. Really important, a page that talks about your privacy. You need to make specific privacy commitments, I think, and you need to make specific security commitments, and you need to tell people what those are. And so we have a page, Your Privacy, and feel free to steal this privacy page for your own course that covers all aspects of your privacy and your security, what cookies we collect, what information we collect, how we use it, etc. And then finally, contact information. I think there should be contact information on every single page. Really important to give people some way of getting directly in touch with you. One of the things, if I had a three-hour session instead of a one-hour session, I'd go through my email, because I've been saving all of these, and talk about all the different support requests I've gotten. I can't log on. My password has disappeared. My email has changed. The course is down. The course is up. The course is too slow. The course is missing. Can I have a recording early? Etc. And steal with attribution, Creative Commons, whatever, you know, other people make a big fuss about licensing and that, and I really don't care. If it's useful to you, use it. That's all I can say. But one of the things, but this is an important point, in the Your Privacy page, it's important to tell people what the status of their contributions will be. When you are contributing to a Connectivist course, you are contributing in a public environment. You're going to be posting on your own blog. You're going to be posting on public forums. This is not a private, closed-off course, the way a learning management system course might be. You need to make participants aware of that ahead of time. You need to say, the stuff that you're posting on your open blog is open. Anybody can see it. Anybody can read it. It's not just going to be seen and read by the people inside this course. That's a really important component of the course. The whole course happens in the open. It happens in the public. We have people who follow these courses who have never signed up. There's no record, except maybe in the server logs, that they've ever come in, looked at stuff in the course, and left. That's good. It's in a Connectivist course, there's no clear line between in the course and out the course, out of the course. But people need to be aware of that when they're contributing. They need to know that what they're doing in a public environment. Some people might say, well, some people prefer private environments. Quite so. If you want a private environment, the Connectivist MOOC answer is feel free, go ahead, set one up. We won't stop you. We encourage that, but by its very nature, because it's private, we don't know you're doing it. No problem. We know that students do this for regular courses in regular universities anyways, and we just say, that's part of the course. We expect you probably will, and power to you. In any Connectivist course, any MOOC, a variety of different software applications will be used. Some typical ones include Moodle. We don't use Moodle anymore for the Connectivist courses, but other open online courses do use Moodle. Moodle's very popular because it allows you to create these course pages. It allows you to create a discussion list. It allows you to mount resources. What I don't like about Moodle is that it tends to centralize people instead of setting up their own course page, just set up camp in Moodle and say, well, this is a good discussion board. I'm going to spend the entire course inside Moodle, which is fine, but Moodle isn't as open as it could be. The default is, you have to be logged into Moodle, logged into course in order to even see the stuff that's in the course. Also, with the central discussion lists, what happens is you have dominance games, and very often these lists end up dominated by two or three power users, and then everybody else is along for the ride. And there's a real participation curve there. And I find that when people are writing in their own space, they're more likely to write. They're more likely to write without worrying that so-and-so is going to come down on them and make a nasty comment, etc. I find it to be a more equitable way of writing. But if you like that thing, there's Moodle. And anybody can set up their own Moodle. Or if you like that thing, there's Google Groups. Google Groups will set up the same sort of discussion environment as Moodle does. Zed's pointing out in the comment area, he says that Edmodo is the big thing for facilitating a course now as well. And again, these sorts of online services can be used. And the idea here is you're setting up an environment for resources, for sharing, for discussion, etc. One service that has worked really well for some people is WordPress. Jim Groom uses WordPress for DS106 and does all of his sharing through that. I really like that because, there's commentability, but it's not really the focus of WordPress. There is, the ability to have a discussion, and it can even be threaded if you want, although don't get me started on threaded discussion lists. But it almost pushes people away because a WordPress blog, which is really what it is, tends to be created by an individual. And the individual in this case would be Jim, and whoever is working with Jim, Alan Levine, is currently working on DS106 with Jim. And that's their contribution. And other participants in the DS106 course need to set up their own online environments. In fact, it's the first assignment in that course. Set up your own web server, set up your own domain name and all of that. I don't think we necessarily have to have all of that for an ordinary MOOC, but for that MOOC, certainly it's a requirement, and it's a good one. Or there are other content, comment, sharing sites. Digo is a popular one. Twitter is a popular one, obviously. Facebook, very often people will set up a corresponding Facebook page. We did that, for Connectivism. These days, pretty much for any project that I set up, I would set up a Facebook page that people can like and join and get messages from. Second Life, not so popular now, but again, you can set up areas in Second Life, and there's a whole range of other tools. These are just the tools that have been popular. There are thousands and thousands of tools that you can use. Each course is a different mixture of them. Use the tools that work for you. Zed's asking, what about Second Life? Is it really working for engaging learning? Well, here's how this works, Zed. The people who like Second Life really, 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 really like Second Life. For them, it totally works. And if people want to do sessions in Second Life, they should be encouraged to do so. And when we've had Second Life groups form in our Connectivism course, we, George and myself, have gone into Second Life with our vanilla characters and done presentations in Second Life for them. You know, it depends, and Carol's saying it depends on the participants in Second Life. You know, there's an old saying here in Canada, different strokes for different folks. You know, some people like Second Life, other people hate it. Me, kind of, eh, whatever. It doesn't do it for me, but that's just me. Other people love World of Warcraft, and they wanted to set up a clan, or I don't even know what the groupings are in World of Warcraft, but I know there are some. You can do it. Why not? Minecraft. Some people have been doing coursework in Minecraft. Again, there's no limits on the environments that you can use. What's really key is people choose their own environments. And they choose the environment that works for them. And the idea of a MOOC is that we're linking these environments together. Moving on. So, all right. That's the overview. It's a very rough overview. I've probably missed a bunch of things, but those are the overall elements of the MOOC. Now, I want to talk a bit about preparing for the MOOC, because, you know, obviously you can't just do a MOOC. First thing is you have to put all of those elements into place. Me, I use Grasshopper. I set up a new, nice, clean instance of Grasshopper. I'll typically give it its own web address. Which means that I'm setting up a domain name for it, like cck11 or cck12.mooc.ca or whatever. If you don't want to buy a domain name, don't. But you're going to need to set up a website, put in the pages, all the pages, and think about the different applications that I've talked about. Okay. As you're getting ready, you're going to need to prepare the way for your participants. And I've given you a bunch of links on this slide here. These are the standard, here's how the whole thing works, resources that we use. There's an article that I wrote, How This Course Works. And it's a little bit different for every course, but I've pretty much got the template down now. Go with that article, read that article, and that'll describe how a MOOC works. Dave Cormier has done a series of three videos that are now classics in the field. What is a MOOC? Success in a MOOC and knowledge in a MOOC. And these really get at the pedagogy of a MOOC. Your biggest challenge, I think, in running a MOOC is going to be people come into it expecting it to be a course just like all the other courses they've ever taken. There's some content, it will be delivered to them, they will receive it, they will remember it, life goes on. And MOOCs aren't like that. I don't know what the content of a MOOC will be before we start. The Connectivism course has never been the same. We have the same resources and the same topics year after year, But each time it's different. Carol's talking about newbies and repeaters. CCK08 was our first year. Everybody was a newbie. CCK09, half the CCK08 class came back into the course. And now we had people who were there for the first time and people who were there for the second time, which was great because people who were there for the second time started to teach people who were there for the first time and actually almost took over the course, which I considered perfection. A little alienating, but nonetheless perfection. It takes more than once to really make sense. Yeah, it does. Again, this is the whole idea that, you know, we don't separate people into levels. There isn't first year, second year, third year, fourth year. It's just you go back and you revisit the MOOC. And the more often you revisit the MOOC, it's like you're covering the same stuff, but more in depth. You're covering the same stuff, but you're explaining more. You're covering the same stuff, but from a different perspective. Nancy, we could talk about the concept of sense making, and I did the little finger quotes thing there if you didn't see that. There's a whole epistemology that I want to talk about regarding that, but that's, again, that's a little off topic. Carol says she's looking at prior MOOCs and learning even more. Absolutely. Yeah, I learn. I do a session like this. I go back and look at the MOOCs. One of the things that I haven't done with the Connectivism MOOCs that I want to do is for CCK 12, which is the one that we're doing right now, and I just haven't had a chance to do this, we should be linking back to all the resources and stuff that was created in 08 and 09 and 11. And we haven't done that, and it just kills me that we haven't done that. There's a whole domain here of cumulatively built MOOCs that we haven't explored properly. We tried with the first two MOOCs just, having it right on the same website, but what we discovered is the second MOOC simply erased the first MOOC, and that was no good. Foundations of community practice, of communities of practice, actually builds that way, building cumulatively over 12 years. The danger with that is cruft. CRUFT. And that what cruft is, anytime you have an artifact and you leave it out there in the world, it's all shiny and new, but then as time goes by, you get a crust that forms around it from dust and birds and all of that. That's cruft. And if you have cruft in a course, it gets harder and harder and harder to understand what the course was. Anyhow, student websites. These are the big four. We tell them, create a website wherever, and this is where they create them. Blogger, WordPress, and recently, like in the last 18 months, Tumblr and Postgres have become huge. The strategy of not putting it front and center may help avoid that. You have to fish for it a bit. Yeah, exactly. And that's just it. The idea here with any content area, and I try to explain this, and it's really hard. I've talked about software design this way, trying to build the PLE system, and it's almost impossible to explain this to people. But what you want in a software design is a very simple screen. Google's a master, right? Google will search, right? But that basic software, you should be able to click the link and go a level deeper and get some more functionality. Click the link and go a level deeper and get more functionality so that you can go deeper and deeper and deeper into this thing so that it works with a single command. You don't need to know anything, or you can keep digging deeper and deeper. Good, well-designed computer games work this way as well. You sit down to play Civilization or NHL hockey or any of these video games. Nobody reads the instructions, right? You sit down, you start playing. And if they're well-designed, you can start playing right away. But as you get better, you explore the commands, you explore the possibilities, you get deeper and deeper into it. And similarly, with the content, which isn't the stuff that you're learning, remember, it's just the resources that you're working with. Similarly, with that content, on the surface, there's just some simple content, but you can go deeper into it, and you can go deeper into it, and you go deeper into it. So, these are the top four, and if people are asking for recommendations, recommend them these things in this order. they're very easy to use. They're exactly like the software I've just described. Somebody can go into a Blogger or any of these four, and without really knowing any of these things, they can actually use any of these applications. Google Sites works as well. Google Sites is a bit different because you're creating a website rather than a web blog, so the structure is going to be a bit different. Harvesting isn't going to work as well. I wouldn't recommend it, but it's a MOOC. You can do it if you want. All right, moving on, because we do have a time limit here. All right, Q key element of a MOOC is the RSS harvest. Without the RSS harvest, you don't have a MOOC. Now, that does not mean that all MOOCs have a centralized RSS aggregator. That's not what it means at all. But what it does mean is, if you just have a whole bunch of scattered individuals, each person working on their own website, you don't have a MOOC. It's really important that there be some way for these things all to be connected. And the way to do it, the technology du jour, is to use RSS. RSS is tricky for a lot of people. It's getting easier for a lot of people, but you need to tell them how to do it. I should have put a link here on this slide, but in the Change MOOC, in all of the MOOCs, we have actual video help for people to find their RSS. Let me pop in here and I'll show you what I mean. So here I am popping in back into the screen again, and I'm going to pop into, it doesn't matter. I'll just pop into Change 11 again. I'll go to the home page. And so I have a page down here. This is a set of participating links, and I should have created a slide for these, but one of these participating links is add a new blog feed. And when we go into the add a new blog feed, it's really important to give people instructions, because dollars to donuts, people don't know what RSS is. They don't know, and more importantly, they don't care. And that's fine. You don't expect them to know this coming in. Second time, third time, you kind of begin to expect it. But really, the first time, you know. So I've created on this page some videos. I've got a video for the Plank course. I've got a video for the Critical Literacies course. And I'll just pop the URL here into the chat room. And this is going to be the same pretty much for any system. It's described for the Grasshopper in general, but the elements finding your RSS feed is going to be the same for pretty much every course. And really, it's very simple. If you go into, let's go into half an hour, for example. So here's my half an hour blog. And if we look up somewhere in the menu bar at the top, there's the little RSS symbol that looks like a dot with waves. And if you click on that, you see several links to telling you how to subscribe to the RSS feed. And the address of the web page that you go to when you click on that is the address of the RSS feed. I'm showing you the RSS feed now for my blog. You're seeing the formatted version. But if we look at the source, oh, it's not going to look nice, is it? Oh, that's too bad. well, okay, there's the source, and it's all messed up because the viewer isn't good. But if you look at the source, it's basically, it's XML encoding. There are ways, and I have a guide out there that describes how to create your own RSS feed by hand. But you don't really need to know that. The main thing you need to know is this address. If you know that this is the address of your RSS feed, everything else falls into place. So you tell participants, here's how to find your RSS feed. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, here's where to send it. And in Grasshopper, we have a special page, the new feed page, which is what you're seeing here. And there's where we have them put their RSS feed URL. I have other spaces for title, author, webpage URL, and it's nice if they fill those in, but the really important thing, and the only thing I care about really, really, is the RSS feed URL. Here's why. When you submit the RSS feed URL, you're submitting the address of that RSS feed, which means now that I, the person who has received your RSS feed, can now aggregate your blog. Now, what that means is I can set up a computer program that automatically brings in the content from your blog into a central area. And that's what I do. That's how it works with the MOOC. So what we do is we have people submit their RSS feeds, and then I go in as the administrator, and again, I'm using Grasshopper here. I go in as the administrator. I see a list of feeds. Here are all the feeds, and right now there are 293 feeds that have been submitted for change. In Grasshopper, you're able to analyze the feed or approve the feed. I see I have a new feed here, so I'll approve the feed. This is called A Chronicle for a Learning Journey. Thank you, whoever submitted it. It's nice to have an example right at the top. And then now I click on Harvest. I can use Grasshopper, and this is happening in real time, so I don't know what I'll get here, is harvesting the feed, processing the contents, and putting them in the database. Really, really useful, because now I can take the contents of this database and send it to other people. And I'll just take a sip of coffee while my clock chimes here. I'm not going to want to go on too much longer, but there is other stuff I want to cover, so I'm going to do that. And Zed did say I could go a little over if I wanted. So tell me when you really want me to stop. Now, you don't have to use Grasshopper to do this. Google Reader, anybody in the course can use Google Reader. And one of the things that I do is I make the list of feeds available. I make it available as a plain web page, and I also make it available as what's called an OPML file. And what an OPML file is a simple file that you can feed into an RSS reader like Google Reader, and it will take the whole list of RSS feeds and ingest them. I love that word, ingest. So Google Reader, and I use Google Reader a lot, not just for my courses, but, well, for everything. Here's Google Reader, and I'm not sure how much you can see here, but these are all the feeds that I subscribe to on Google Reader, all the internet. I'm subscribing to 199 separate, oh no, that's 199 new posts, not 199 separate edubloggers. I subscribe overall to about just under 1,000 feeds. That seems to be about the top for me. I can't really go more than that. And they're all on different subjects. But the idea here is Google Reader brings all of this content into a single environment. WordPress has the same feature. You can get a plugin for WordPress, and this is what Jim Groom has done. He collects RSS feeds. I think I'm not sure if he does this, but this is what I would do if I was him, probably. I think he uses a Google spreadsheet, Google Document spreadsheet to collect the RSS feeds, and then you feed that into the WordPress aggregator, and WordPress can become an aggregator. You need to install the RSS feed aggregator module for WordPress. Drupal, D-R-U-P-A-L, is a content management system. It's not on the slide, so I'll type the name of it here. I'm using that for a local website that I've created called Moncton Free Press, and that also has an RSS aggregator most other content management systems will have an RSS harvesting feature. So if people create RSS feeds, then you can aggregate their content, and there's a little application I'll show you a little bit later on. You can actually bring that content straight into a Facebook page or a Twitter feed if you want. You don't have to even use these aggregators. This is why I say a MOOC is not centralized. Strictly speaking, Grasshopper is only a convenience. We could run the MOOC without a centralized aggregator. It's just that means each individual person would have to manage their own aggregators. Aggregators are still a little hard to run. So we provide that as a service. But the idea is people could do this on their own if they wanted. They don't need us. And that's the key thing. They don't need the centralized location. All right, moving on. There's specialized harvest as well. And what I mean by that is you don't have to harvest only blogs. You can set up your harvester to harvest a bunch of different types of content. One harvest I do is the Twitter subject feed. Remember I talked about a tag, and Zed's putting in the chat area, Twitter hashtags. I harvest an RSS feed for a Twitter search for the CCK12 hashtag. And then I take that feed and pass that along. Dejo is another area where people can put in, add resources and add comments. Delicious, the same sort of thing. Add resources and add comments or tags for those resources. You can, oh, thank you. Yeah, Zed's put a URL, on using Twitter hashtags to amplify your HTML. And the idea here is that you use these hashtags, you create a search in these three, Twitter, Dejo, and Delicious, for that hashtag, and then you harvest the RSS feed from that service. It's a little too technical to go into detail now, especially, you know, given the amount of time, but the main point is this can be done, and there's a really nice addition to the sort of connecting that you can provide. Google Groups, same thing. You can harvest the RSS from a Google group. I mentioned harvesting directly into Facebook or Twitter. I use a service quite a bit, more and more now, called ifttt.com. It stands for If This Then That, and it's so useful. What you can do is you can take any kind of content and import it, if this, and then send it anywhere else, then that. So if this, then that. Explore it. And finally, Feed 43 is something that I've been exploring. Take an ordinary web page, turn it into an RSS feed. So again, there's specialized kind of harvest that you can use to really augment the harvesting that's going on in your course. Next, you want to set up your synchronous environment. We use Illuminate. We've tested all of the rest of them. And Illuminate, for our purposes, Illuminate's pretty much the best. But what system is this, Zed? Can you put it in the chat box? It's not any of these, I don't think, which is interesting. There are different synchronous conferencing environments available. This one seems to be working pretty well. I don't know how well it would work for a large group. It's Flash-based, so the sound isn't as good as it could be. Oh, this is feed43.com. No, you're still on another subject, I think. This isn't feed43, I don't think, that we're in right now. Yeah, just sharing sites you mentioned. Thank you. Anyhow, the Flash-based ones like Adobe Connect and BigBlueButton, the screen sharing is pretty good, sound less so. Others, WiseIQ, Fuse, WebEx, they're commercial products and they evolve overhead. So does Collaborate. If you have no money, you're probably looking at Blackboard Collaborate. Illuminate is really expensive now. Yeah, that's true. And for many, if you're just running a MOOC out of your basement, Illuminate's probably not going to do it for you. Then you'd be either using BigBlueButton or you'd be using a free or low rent version of Fuse or WiseIQ or something like that. Really, I wasn't happy with any of them. I really wasn't. Collaborate certainly has done the job for us. What is this? This is WiseIQ that we're in now. Okay. Now, WiseIQ is a pretty popular solution as well. But again, it's, the Adobe sound, so the audio isn't going to be perfect. The main thing I want to point, I want to say with respect to synchronous conferencing, if you're going to do it, make sure you have your synchronous conferencing environment set up and tested ahead of time, and be prepared for it to falter. You know, you're going to be doing some troubleshooting, especially if you have large numbers. Now, the next major element of the MOOC, Zed is saying, do you foresee Facebook or Google Hangouts will have these web conferencing tools soon? You know, oh, I should have mentioned this. One of the things, and Dave Cormier is a big fan of this, is using Skype or Google Hangout to set up for 3- or 4-way video conferencing, and then taking that and running it through either Ustream, and I think the URL is ustream.tv, or Livestream, which is what we've been using more recently. And the idea here is you can provide a full video live stream to people, and they can see everything that you're doing in the discussion. So it's just like one of these presentations, and you can have the interactive conversation. Jeff Lebo has this down pat. Yeah, he totally does. And you can do this for free, and it's really simple. I've done some experimenting with both Hangouts and Skype through these services. They work pretty well. As well, you can take the audio from these things and broadcast them through something like web radio. Now, I've run into some broadcast problems recently with Windows 7, where when you're in a conferencing environment, it's not letting you snag the audio stream to send into your environment. But I'm solving that today with a second computer. Turns out the computers are often the cheapest part of the system. If you just have any recording device handy, or even like an iPhone or something like that, you can upload audio into one of these web radio environments. Again, though, there's different combinations here, and the thing to do, as always, is to experiment. But I want to focus on the key thing in a MOOC, in my experience, and that is the newsletter. The newsletter is the central thread that runs through the course. It is not strictly, absolutely necessary. You could probably have a MOOC without a newsletter, but who would know it's a MOOC? It's one of these things. It's a really valuable service for people. In the surveys that we've done, it always comes back as the most useful, most important element of the course. It just kills me. Traditional LMS-type courses don't typically have this, at least not to my experience, and I don't understand that. Although more and more you're seeing notifications being sent by these courses, and they serve the same function as a newsletter. I use Grasshopper to produce the newsletter because that's what it's built for, but you don't have to use Grasshopper. You can use any content stream. A Facebook page works equally well. Twitter works equally well. What I do is I output the newsletter in Grasshopper by email. I send it by email to all the people who've signed up for it, but I also create an RSS feed because Grasshopper produces RSS. And then I take the RSS, I feed it through ifttt.com and send that to Facebook and to Twitter. Sumify, don't have experience with Sumify. Haven't used it. Might work really well. Probably does work really well. I'll have to try it. Good suggestion. WordPress can be used to create an email newsletter. Summary of your social news feeds. Oh, okay. It's a summary of social news feeds. It works as a fine reminder on a daily basis. Absolutely, it would. I put in a link here to designing email newsletters. It's a whole topic all by itself. I keep my email newsletters pretty simple. I don't want them to be too complicated. But again, what I have is the RSS version, which becomes the Twitter and the Facebook version. I have the web version, and then I have the email version. And I'll just share, just so you can see it quickly, an email newsletter. So we'll go back into the change course. And, of course, the newsletter. Here's the Read Daily Newsletters right in the participation links. And here we can see in this newsletter all the different components of the course all wrapped up. Here are the blog posts that have been aggregated. Here is the Twitter content. I've harvested all the Twitter comments. You can see people are using the Change 11 tag in Twitter, and that's how I'm harvesting it. Lots of Twitter activity. Lots and lots of Twitter activity. Oh, and that's it. Well, that's a pretty slow day in the old Change newsletter. Isn't that interesting? Let's look at the newsletter archives. This is always useful to have. We'll go back to an earlier version. Here's the newsletter. Here we've got some announcements, right? You know, a research study, etc., etc. Blog post. Here's the Twitter, and it goes on. Oh, maybe I'm not using. Oh, yeah. Let me go. I don't think I'm using the other arc. No wonder. I'm going to go into the Connectivism course. So that's the ckk12.mooc.ca. Let's look at the newsletter there. I thought it was, again, I'll go back into the archives here. Newsletter archives. It's nice to have newsletter archives. I'll pop in. So, and here's the discussion threads. Here are the DJO posts that have been harvested. That's what's really taken. There's always something different in every course, right? For CCK12, the big thing has been DJO, and the DJO groups have just taken off, and then there's some Twitter posts. So each newsletter is different. The combinations, here's some discussion threads, CCK12 discussion board that we've set up. And again, if you post anything on this board, Matt Burry set this board up, and I said, cool, and started harvesting it, etc. The idea is that your newsletter is all of your daily content pulled together in one nice handy place that, where people can look at it. Very, very important component of your course. And like I say, technically you can run a MOOC without it. I don't recommend it. If you're going to have research, set up your research group ahead of the course. Set it up with its own separate Google group and Google Documents. Make sure you have your research ethics down. We have some sample stuff on research ethics in the personal learning environments course. And that's connect.downs.ca. And there's information about the research somewhere in here. It's going to be in one of the archives. So, I'm not going to be able to find it right by looking, but if you explore this, you'll find information about the research ethics, or if you just do a Google search, Planck and research ethics, you should find something. I'm just checking that really quickly. And, it's giving me Planck instead of Planck. Google's getting really annoying with that auto-suggestion recently. The main point I want to make here is set up your research ahead of time and make sure that your research ethics are taken care of. You need to tell people that they're being researched. That's the simple principle. And you need to allow them to opt out. Otherwise, you're going to violate research ethics across the board. Surveys, and especially opt-in surveys, are really popular. SurveyMonkey, Lime Survey. I've done some tests with the Google survey forms, and it's a good idea. It works really well. Basically, a Google survey is a front-end, just a form-based input, and then it pops into a spreadsheet in the back-end. Really handy, because then all of your results are in a spreadsheet. Think of other things you can access as well for research. Server logs are a big one. I use AW stats to do my server logs. I have a cat that's getting impatient for me to finish here. Hi, Alex. This cat does not have scratches on his face. He's the winner of the recent fight. Just to wrap up, running the MOOC, it's an ongoing process. There's a bunch of things you need to do on a regular basis. To launch it, advertise it ahead of time, tweet it, put it on Facebook. And as people sign up, send them a welcoming newsletter explaining, well, telling them, first of all, yes, your sign up has been successful, because people don't know, right? And you don't want them to just sign up and then see nothing. Send them a welcome newsletter. Set up your research group if you're doing that. Open up the registration page for people to sign up to your course. Those are the main things. But you should also at this time be doing things like lining up your guests, lining up your topics, putting all of your content in place. Each week is different. MOOCs tend to go week by week, topic by topic. That's generally been the model. If you have a guest speaker, it's really important to confirm ahead. Send them an introductory email explaining all the processes. How do they sign into the MOOC? How do, what conferencing system will they use? And what will they need for that? What do you expect from them? In our change MOOC, we send them a letter saying, we expect that, here's what we expect. We want a summary of your contribution, 500 to 1,000 words. It's important to be that specific, because otherwise they don't know, right? And you don't want them to write a book when really all you wanted was a short contribution. If we want them to do a presentation, what are the parameters? Do they want slides or no slides? Is it a discussion, a lecture like this? Tell them so they know. They want to know. Don't just say, oh, do whatever you want. Tell them what you want, and then they can negotiate with you from there. And then also we ask them to suggest activities for people to do for their week. So put all this in an email and send it up. Line up your resources, your background materials. If you're going to have a guest, read some of their stuff. Make sure you have some of their links handy. Why is this useful? Well, we had a guest today, this week, the expected materials never arrived, but I had the background material handy. In the 10 minutes that I had before the email goes out, I assembled the material and made that the information package for this week. Have this material ahead of time. Each week, you're going to go through some sort of weekly routine. You could do this all before the course ever starts. I've tried that and it didn't really work. I like to do the week by week. You're building the course fresh each week. Carol is saying it helps have several people to moderate, set up, and run a MOOC. Not an easy solo act. Not an easy solo act. I agree. Totally. There's a lot of stuff to do. Each week, what do I do? Set up a new author listing, add the readings and information for the week. I add those resources to Grasshopper. If you're running Google Sites or a blog, you'd be adding the resources to the blog. Sometimes you need to schedule resources. If you have events, schedule the events. Make sure that they're in your Google Calendar. Add these new events listings. Add any weekly activities that you have. Create a page for that week. If we look at the change MOOC, you'll see that we have a new page for each week. And I'll just pop into it quickly here. So here it is. We have, and we're up to week 24. I've added each one of these pages each week. So each week, here's the content that I've added. I've added announcements, event sessions. I've set up, and this will come up later, the recordings and that, and the resources, etc. Each week I do this as well. and make sure that this shows up on the home page. So this is the home page for Change, and you can see week 24, Geetha, Narayanan, and slow learning, the resources and all of that. And again, these are the resources that I had prepared ahead of time, just in case, and I needed them this week. So you need to set all of that up. Again, I do this in the back end, and what I do is I create new posts. So here, for example, here's the list of posts. Here's the intro post for Geetha Narayanan, and you can see here's the content that I put into it. It's an announcement. There's when it publishes, all of that. And then the newsletter is going to include this stuff. So I have several pages that I need to be attending to for any given week. So here's the weekly page, and you can take a look here. So I've set up the weekly page, and then I've set up what these are requests to the database. So if I submit an announcement, this announcement will show up automatically on this page. But I need to set up this page so that it collects the right announcements. Similarly, with the newsletter page, I need to make sure that that's working properly. Here's the newsletter page. Here's what it looks like. As you can see, these are the requests for all the different content type. This doesn't change week to week, but you need to test the newsletter. So I do a test of the newsletter every week, every day if possible, although sometimes I just don't have time, and just to make sure it looks okay before it goes out. And then finally, of course, the home page, and I'm making sure that the home page is updated each week with all the contents for that week. So, what really helps me is the database magic, and if I can convince my partners of this, it would help me even more. But the idea here is the content that goes in as different content types, posts, events, presentations, etc., things like that. And then the content that comes out is a different type of page. The weekly summary page, the daily newsletter, the front page, the author page. And the idea here is the contents that go in are allocated through the database dynamically to the output pages. Now, WordPress can't do this. Grasshopper does do this. A content management system like Drupal or Joomla will do this. And there's a learning curve to doing this. A lot of people, most people, including George, find it easier just to create a wiki page for each week and not to worry about that. But then everything's in the wiki page, right? And you're not getting specialized pages. Your newsletter now, you're going to have to copy and paste from your wiki page or find some way of emailing a different wiki page, etc. Well, it's going to be a lot harder to do a daily newsletter. It's going to be a lot harder to manage your aggregation because you want your aggregation, you want the contents of the blogs that you brought in to go into these different things. So I use a content management system. I use Grasshopper because I built it. It works really well. But any content management system will make your life a million times easier if you're dealing with many different types of content. But there's a learning curve there. Content management systems are complex, and you need to wrap your mind around the idea of working with data rather than with documents. And if you don't get that, then content management system probably won't work for you. You probably just want to use blog posts and content streams. Well, for example, the way Jim Groom does with WordPress and the aggregator module in WordPress. Now, am I still sharing? I don't think so. Okay. Daily routine. Remember to check for your feeds. it's easy to forget because you get a big flurry of them. In Grasshopper, I review the feeds before harvesting them, and I do that not so much because of content. That's really not been a problem. I do it because people get the URL of their RSS feed wrong. Even though I have a help page, even though I have handy videos, I still get, the first time I did it, I was getting like a 25% error rate. Now, with the more recent courses, is about 10, 15% error rate. The thing is, it's a high enough error rate, it's worth your time to check and make sure that they've put in the right URL. And that their feed works. Also, I've been doing it because I've been writing my aggregator as I go along. My aggregator aggregates a whole pile of stuff from different sources, and you need to be able to manage each kind of data individually. Every day you should certainly check your newsletter. I use Cron, which is a type of system that automatically sends the newsletter for me. What it is a service on my web service, on my web server, that automatically executes a command in my program. So all of the newsletters send automatically, and that's how I can have like 10 minutes before the newsletter goes, I got to rush to do something because I have this preset to send for me. But I checked the newsletter before it sends because I don't want to send junk. And I've learned from experience that it's really easy to send junk. Preparing for events. You have to prepare for events. Send a letter ahead of time for the guest. Tell them when it is. Use the universal, whatchamacaller thingy. I'm sorry. The universal date time calculator. Zed, you should have the URL for that because I gave it to you for this session. If you just pop it in the chat room. To coordinate your time zones. Time zones are really hard. And if you're working halfway around the world, you want to use something like that. And I'm still waiting. Is he typing? No, he's not typing. Zed's coming for a coffee break. So I'll look it up. Time zones. Here it is. It's called the World Clock. It's timeanddate.com. And there are different services that you can use. I use the Event Time Announcer, there are other ways you can do it. The Event Time Announcer is the easiest thing. I've actually got that programmed into Grasshopper, so Grasshopper outputs links that are pre-configured to correspond with this Event Time Announcer. So I'll come back in. Oh, there you go. He's got it added. All right, good. Thanks. I'll put it in anyways because I went and found it. Use that. Send a letter to your guest ahead of time, specifying the time, giving the exact URL to log on, and do what Zed did right before the session. Send that URL again. That was really handy for me. Send the expectations. What do they need to do about slides? Do they need to do anything? Do you want them to email you the slides? Do you want them uploaded? Say ahead of time. Prepare ahead of time for how you're going to record the session. Record the session. Again, I use Audacity. I do an audio recording of everything that I participate in. I found that to be really helpful. Illuminate doesn't always record. This session is recording. Yeah, no, it's new, Carol. It's not in the version that you have. perhaps you can use Camtasia if you're live streaming it. Livestream has a recording. WiseIQ and other synchronous conference applications have in-app recording. Think about it ahead of time. Think about what you want to do because this is going to be your event follow-up. Always follow up. Post the audio, video, and other recordings. When I do presentations like this one, for example, on my own website, I create a separate web page for every single presentation I do. I haven't done the same for these MOOCs. I should. I need to make this better. I need to fix Grasshopper so that it handles this stuff better. But what you want, ideally, is a separate event page for every event that has the recording of the event. Any photos, any video, any resources, etc. I do that for all of my online talks. So on my website, downs.ca, tomorrow you will see a a link and a page specifically for this event. I think it'll be number 290. 30 minutes easy, yeah. Update your recordings page if on the MOOCs that we have. I don't have event pages, but I do have a page that lists all of the recordings. Update any other course pages. What the easiest thing is if you can just feed all of this data, all of these links, into the content management system and then have it all propagate. But again, everybody needs to be on the same page for that. And then send a nice thank you email for your guest because your course was that much better for their participation. And that's basically the process of conducting a MOOC. I know, guaranteed, I've left out more than I've included, but you know, I've gone on for an hour and a half now, and this is as much detail about the process that I use that I can slide into a single presentation as possible. So I'm going to end the audio, and Zed will...
Thank you very much. It was excellent. I think some of us might be kind of overwhelmed and not probably thinking about doing a MOOC, but I think we can learn a lot, even if not doing a MOOC, just doing an online course. We can learn about, for example, especially the students use the blogs and Twitter and Facebook groups to engage within themselves and also with the teachers. I think, to me, people are talking about Mahara for e-portfolio. I prefer, my personal opinion, I prefer that students just have blogs. What do you think about that, the Mahara? I mean, do you have any opinion on Mahara as an e-portfolio system, or do you recommend perhaps students just use blogs?
I would just use blogs. More accurately, I would use a set of different services for different purposes. Here's what I use, right? And again, everybody has different tastes. It's really important, right? For some people, Mahara is going to be fantastic. For other people, it's going to be, what, another application? No, I can't deal with it. I use, for my videos, I upload them to blip.tv. I love Blip. It's not for everyone. It's actually pretty hard to figure out how to upload your videos in Blip. For most people, YouTube will do the job. I like Blip because I can use long things. Slides, I upload to SlideShare. They've been good. They've been bad. These days are good. You can upload using, I think, SlideRocket is another one. Whatever. For photographs and short video clips, I use Flickr. Well, only for photos. I've never uploaded a video clip to Flickr, but other people have. What else? For documents, I use Google Docs, or generally, I'll just upload them to my own website and link to them, or I'll put text into Google. You know, I don't think it's necessarily to have an e-portfolio application. I think it's necessary to have some sort of web presence that brings all of these things together. So, you know, if you have content scattered all over the web, you need some sort of page that says, you know, here's where my photos are, here's where my videos are, etc. But, you know, I don't see an e-portfolio as being strictly necessary.
Okay, no, I was asking the question because our university is a medical university, so we were looking at solutions so that we capture the students' work from semester one until the end of the program. And it's easy to find, for example, than just using Word documents everywhere and so on. So that's why I was just asking, from your experience, have you tried Mahara before? Is there any... Because they are thinking about using Mahara here, but I'm still more pro blogs, whether it's Tumblr or Blogger or WordPress or...
Yeah, resist the urge to centralize.
Okay.
Institutions want everybody to deposit their stuff on the institutional system. And that sounds like a really good idea, and it's all very convenient for the institution. But when you leave the institution, what happens to all your stuff? And I'm speaking here from the student's perspective, the participant's perspective, right? Insist, you know, use your own site to store your stuff. And if the institution is so annoying as to require you to upload to their system, then do so. But if you can get away with just sending them a link, do that. It's so much easier. And you get to keep your stuff after you've graduated.
Okay. I was just wondering, now we have still, they have made it through another, we still have about 18, 19 people here. Maybe you have some questions you would like to ask Stephen Downs, whether it's regarding MOOC or anything regarding online learning, since we have him here. He has his coffee, he has his cats. So let's ask him some questions about maybe you have some problems with your teaching and learning using technology and so on. This is a good time to ask one that has extensive experience since, I don't know, 1985, 95. So it's a good time to ask questions now in the chat box.
And in 1985, while I'm waiting for people to type, I see Carol is typing. In 1985, I was working on the student newspaper at the University of Calgary. I was editor of something called The Gauntlet. Uh-huh. And, oh, that was so much fun. Carol is writing, it may be a good idea for the participants to create their own personal portfolios to take with them. It then is a PLE for each individual. Yeah. That's basically what I've been working on, Carol. In the ideal world, each person will have their own server and their resources will be on their own server and then backed up, right? The world isn't quite that ideal yet. But I think we're moving in that direction where people will just, you know, have a record of all of their stuff on their own server, but not yet. How does one best survive using the newer learning philosophies in the traditional venues? Yeah, by making lots of compromises. No, there's an old saying in the British Navy from the age of tall ships, where, you know, people would climb around in the rigging in the middle of storms. And the saying was, one hand for yourself, one hand for the ship. Or actually, it was the other way around. One hand for the ship, one hand for yourself. And that's a good philosophy generally. You're working in an environment, and you need to do what is required in that environment, and there are going to be policies and procedures, and you're not going to change people's minds. And so you have to go along with that. And indeed, part of the formation of the MOOC was going along with these policies and procedures. On the other hand, you need to keep in mind yourself, your own needs as a learner, and with respect to your own professional development. I have a talk I do, Web 2.0 on your own personal professional development. And when people are asking, you know, how do I use all of these technologies to improve my classes, I say to them, use all of these technologies to improve your own learning. And then use what you can for your classes, but use it for your own learning first, right? And that's the main focus, right? Think of these technologies as the one hand you have for yourself. And eventually you'll find that, you know, if you yourself are well supported with these technologies, then you'll be in a better position to help out other people on whatever ship that you're on.
Okay, anyone else got any questions?
Yeah, and as Carol summarizes, personal learning is key, then adapt what you can.
Hey, Carol, do you want the mic? We could actually give you the mic, you know. If Fariza's here, the assistant can give you the mic if you want. Oh, okay.
Yeah, not really. That's really common in these synchronous sessions as well, where you're interacting more with the chat room than with people. People are reluctant to take up a mic. I don't know. Maybe your experience is different, Seb, but that's been my experience.
Yeah, the same here. But as long as they're interacting, I'm okay. Yes. But if they're not interacting, then that's a problem. But I would like to hear someone else here. We still have about 18 or 17 if you cut out me and you. So it'll be interesting if anyone else have any questions. My boss is here, by the way. I'm not sure if he wants to ask any questions.
Carol says, I like to leave the mic to the pros. I don't know if you can see this. This is the microphone that I use. It's worth investing in a good quality microphone because your audio is so much better. This is an Audio Technica USB microphone. It's a 2020 model, and it's a professional mic. And I use it because I do this kind of stuff professionally. Yeah. It's the old story, get the gear. Even if you're not using a big Audio Technica professional mic, get a good mic. Get a condenser mic rather than simply relying on your headphone microphone. Your headphone microphone is like this big, and because it fits inside the and. You're not getting the quality of sound.
Okay.
And audio quality is really, really important for these online. That's my view.
Anyways. Just curious, how is my audio quality? Because I'm using a decent headset and mic, but not... can you hear me properly, or is it noisy? Yeah. Noisy background?
It's a little bit... Well, it's a little bit scratchy, right? It's not bad, but it's scratchy. Oh,
okay. Yeah, I'll try to get one of those mics. Hopefully the...
Well, and you'll hear, yeah.
Okay. So anyone... Okay, can we... Okay, if no questions, at least can everybody just give a round of applause to our special speaker today for all his efforts actually to come here and give us a session. He's probably the most busy man in the world. You can see how busy he is with his MOOCs alone. So could everyone just give a round of applause and just say, hey, let me know that you're still here also. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone. And you're in Kuala Lumpur, aren't you, Zed?
Yeah, I think.
Still there?
Yeah, we're still. I'm still trying to encourage the webinar culture. Our university is quite new to webinars. This university that I'm working in now, so it's still they're still scared to actually click that button just to enter the classroom. They think it's, you know. They're going to be bullied or whatever, you know. So I'm still working on that. It's a process, but slowly. I think we slowly they're getting it, and hopefully more. Because the fact that the session is recorded also turns them off maybe to attend the live one because they can actually watch the recorded one. So so there's actually sometimes a two way in terms of. But you have to record it because it's valuable learning content.
Dave Cormier found that with EdTech Talk. He found that, you know, they'd get a small audience for EdTech Talk and a big audience listening to the recordings. So that's fine. I mean, I expect that too in the Connectivism courses. So I never worry. 17 attendees, over time, we're speaking to hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah, but actually we peaked at 24, 25, so.
Yeah.
So, but
25. Yeah, that's pretty good for a live session.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, we're working on it. I'm trying different marketing methodologies, but I'm not that good at marketing yet. In terms of, I'm doing my best. So I don't know if you're probably now it's about nearly 12 o'clock. So I suppose you're planning to.
Yeah, it is.
But thank you very much.
Sleep.
Thank you very much, and everybody has thanked you and. I will send you the URL. I'll just send you this. You can use this one or. Okay, let me just wait one second. I will update this post here. The link is there. And if you want to share, I'll put in the recorded version. The downloadable version we'll put a bit later, but we'll also make the downloadable version there also so people can download it. Because I realize a lot of people, if they're in remote areas, they can actually download it and then run it offline. The only problem is
it's a lot better that way, isn't it?
Yeah, but the only problem is the recorded session will have that first half an hour at the moment because I can't do post editing. The first half an hour, which is no session, but they can actually jump. They can jump, so I'll recommend them to jump. Okay, so thank you very much. Maybe if you can actually just jump up, but thank you again very much. It's amazing that you actually took the time to be with us. And hopefully this session can be benefit not only those who attended, but people that did not attend and actually can view the recorded version later. And so thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Okay. So you want me to kick you out, or I'll kick myself out? Or
all right, I'm just going to hit the X button. All right.
Yeah, bye, thank Zed. You very much. Thank
bye,
you, thank
Carol.
You.
Bye, Nancy. Bye, The Rock. Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.